Gary, the more I study the Constitution, the more I also hear from people who claim they want their freedom, but for some reason they think the Constitution is inimical to it. And it seems to be that they believe in something that has off and on been referred to as the Philadelphia Conspiracy. What do you know about that?
Patriot mythology. Let's look what I've heard on the Philadelphia conspiracy is these guys behind closed doors conspired to impose upon us a government. When they agreed to it, even though some objected and went home, when they agreed to it, it was foisted on the American people, and it's there to serve the elite, all kinds of things. So I guess we've got to look realistically at what happened in Philadelphia. They were sent together to revise the Articles of Confederation. And I don't want to get into detail on the Articles of Confederation at this point, but there were problems with the Articles of Confederation. And they looked at them, and it was impossible to amend them. It required a unanimous vote in some case to make any changes to the Articles of Confederation. So you'd need all 13 colonies, single representative. I mean, if they came up with revisions, for example, it would go back to the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, and each colony or state would have one vote, and it had to be unanimous to make any changes in the Articles of Confederation. Other things could be done with, I think, three quarters vote, but here we're in a situation where it's almost impossible to get complete unanimity in any change, because if it affects one state favorably, it will probably affect another state unfavorably. So proposals were made for a revised form of government, and they spent months going through all this stuff. And there were some. The ones that left were conscientious about the specific instructions to submit revisions to the Articles of Confederation. But this comes down to a matter of interpretation. If they submitted the changes, they would have to meet that unanimous consent. If they submitted a change to the overall Articles of Confederation, then they would be complying, but there was nothing binding but what they did. The only thing that the Articles of Confederation and that Congress did was call for their assembly. So though they had the instructions to for revisions, that didn't preclude them from coming up to an alternative, because it would still be subject to the determination of the parties, and we'll get to that again in a little while. So they developed a new form of government based on the experience that they had over the last 12 years or 11 years since the Declaration of Independence, but 12 years since the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And they came out with what amounted to a recommendation. It was nothing more than a piece of paper at that point. And everybody assumes that it was foisted on the American people at that time, not realizing, not recognizing that within the document itself, at let me see which article that was, Article 7, the ratification of the conventions of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this constitution between the states so ratifying the same. So there would exist under the Constitution a government, but it would only apply to the nine states that ratified it. The others could join or not. Any state could join or not. They would be independent at that point. Now, then it went through the ratification process. It took 2 years for full ratification, but every state had a convention of delegates from various parts, and in many of those states, the selection of delegates was a lower voting standard than was applied to election of representatives in their assemblies. So the idea was to get as many people as possible, of course only white at the time, but as many people as possible to participate in the selection of the delegates. Now, a lot of the delegates were sent to the state conventions with instructions not to ratify. So after, in many of the states, after a few weeks of discussions, they realized that this isn't such a bad deal at all. And a number of states then recessed the convention so the delegates could go back to their constituents and get a release from that obligation to reject it because they felt it was good. So they went back and explained what was happening, and their constituents then said, okay, we release you. Some weren't, but most of them were then released from the obligation to vote against the Constitution so that they could reassemble and then ratify the Constitution. So that process is not something foisted by the people. If anything, it was foisted by the people of the states that ratified upon themselves. It wasn't this elite group of people in Philadelphia. It was the degenerates and their elected delegates that foisted it upon each of the states individually by acceptance to join the Union under the Constitution. And when nine states ratified, the United States of America under the Constitution came into existence. Those that hadn't ratified were still under that perpetual union. But if we think about it, if I leave one, let's look at it this way. Let's suppose we had an extremely large state and they wanted to break into two states. Now, when they break into two states, which is permitted under the Constitution, what would happen would be the primary assembly would allow, the initial state assembly would allow a decision to divide and where the division would be and all that. And once they allow that to be determined by the people, when the people decide on that division, the division becomes reality and the second state is no longer a part of the first. Now, it's nothing different than what happened with the Constitution. They were members of a perpetual union, but once they shifted sides and went with the Constitution, they abandoned that perpetual union. Well, can you abandon a perpetual union? I would say that probably so, because when this was done, the convention was done, it went back to the Congress under the Articles of Confederation that sent it out to the states without comment. So by them sending it out to the states for the ratification conventions, they basically gave consent that if you decide to go with this new government, we are releasing you from the perpetual aspects of the Articles of Confederation. So everything was done with consent. It wasn't foisted on anybody. The Congress under the Articles of Confederation, by sending this out under their authority for review and determination by the states in convention, acquiesced to the conditions laid out within. If they opposed it, if they objected to it, they would not have sent it to the states. So the Constitution, when it left the Philadelphia Conspiracy Convention, had to go back to the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, and it could have been killed right then. But unanimously, or three quarters, and I'm not sure what the vote was on sending it out, but it was either nine states or unanimous, that they said, okay, let's let the people decide. But those people in that Congress also realized over the bickering that was going back and forth between them that we need a better system. So even that Congress agreed that given the choice to the people, let the people decide what form of government they want to pursue. So
Right, and
it's not a conspiracy. What's a conspiracy is these people that want to demean a process that was above board throughout. Now, one other thing that's raised about that is the secrecy of the convention. They closed the doors, they closed the windows, they endured heat and smoke and all this filth to close the doors and keep it from getting out. Now, why did they want to keep it from getting out? Well, because if it got out and hit the newspapers and somebody didn't like this aspect, and heck, they hadn't even decided on this aspect, there would people be outside demonstrating that we don't want this, we don't want that, we don't want anything else. So that would just convolute the process. In fact, a good example of the convolution of the process occurred after it was submitted to the states for ratification. Now, the Federalist Papers are the most well known, but we've got the Anti-Federalist Papers. These were public debates, And they went on for 2 years before we got full ratification, or the nine ratifications required to create the new government. Had that been imposed upon those people gathered in Philadelphia, they might have been 2 years coming out with a damn document to go to the states to be ratified. So it made sense. Each state sent their best statesmen down here to come to an agreement on what would be submitted to the people, and that privacy was there to avoid threats, potential conflict, and everything that would proceed during the process of even writing up the piece of paper. Now, you know, on the Outpost of Freedom library, the debates by Madison, the notes on the debates by Madison are there. And if you go through that, you'll see the extent of discussion, the many proposals that were made and what was accepted. And had the outside influence come into that, it would have taken, again, at least 2 years for them to even get something committed to paper. So much for a conspiracy. The conspiracy is what's happening now in trying to denigrate the Constitution by saying it was foisted on the people.
You know, funny you should say that. You know, I think those who are critical of the Constitutional Convention don't really understand the ratification period of the late 1780s. And I'm glad you brought up the, you know, the Federalists. And yeah, there were also not just the Federalist Papers, but also the Anti-Federalist Papers. And even the so-called Anti-Federalists were conflicted regarding the Articles of Confederation. For instance, for example, Anti-Federalist Paper 21, Sentinel pointed out that the Articles of Confederation failed because there was no enforcement for the collection of impost taxes. On the other end of the scale, Anti-Federalist Paper 22, Candidus proposed a seven-point plan in amending the Articles, which he claimed would negate the necessity for a constitution in the first place. So yeah, you're right, Gary. There was a lot of back and forth very publicly regarding the whether or not to ratify this this new constitution.
But
so
only
I don't...
after there was something to discuss.
Right. And something else I've kind of noticed too about folks who really push this claim of a Philadelphia conspiracy is that they almost always tend to be, well, I'll put it more kindly, they tend to follow Lysander Spooner's conclusion when he said in his No Treason essay that the Constitution has either authorized such a government as we have had or has been powerless to prevent it.
Has authorized a government such as we have or powerless to prevent it? Is that what you said?
That was directly from Spooner. Yeah, that's
Boy,
a quote.
Boy, that's
from...
hard to understand. It did authorize the government we had, but once it authorized that, it's there. You can't authorize and then prevent what you just authorized. So it's kind of oxymoronic to what you read. I don't know what preceded that, but what you read is oxymoronic to the 10th degree, really, isn't it? Am I missing something here?
Well, I think what Spooner was trying to say, probably not all too clearly, was that a tyrannical absolute government, his argument was a tyrannical absolute government was bound to happen because either the Constitution basically would eventually bring about a condition whereby you would have a tyrannical absolute government, or that the Constitution was ineffective in limiting government power and thus it couldn't prevent a tyrannical absolute government from occurring sometime in the future.
Well, the ratification of any amendments, according to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, or Article 5 of the Constitution, was that the states had to ratify for changes. So the government itself. Now, one of the problems that existed in the state constitutions in 1776, April or May 1776, the Continental Congress recommended all states reform or create a constitution, reform their governments, with two exceptions, Connecticut and one other, who retained their charters but removed any reference to Parliament, the King, or royalty, or, you know, any obligation across the ocean. They all created constitutions. But what they did is they created these constitutions in their legislative bodies. There might have been one or two exceptions initially, but they created them within the legislative bodies. Now it was created within the legislative bodies, so then, a year or two later, a lot of them went with 1 year terms, short terms for people in office. So the next year, even the new legislative body, having different sympathies, would undo parts of the Constitution and add parts of the Constitution. So what good is the Constitution if it's going to change every 2 years at the whim of the legislature? So the concept evolved that these should be ratified by the people, the constitutions as well as any amendments. And so this preceded 1787, and the concept picked up by 1787 with one exception. And that exception was amendments to the Constitution can be ratified by the states by their means of selection, but the Constitution itself had to go to conventions within the states. And I think that the amendment process should have also gone to convention, because that concept became very positive then. Only the people can change it. That way, we can't change it every year, back and forth, to serve the needs of whoever's in power at the time. So the idea behind the Constitution evolved from that process, and what we have to have is a fixed document. It has to be subject to change. Now, he says tyrannical. What the Constitution did is it gave powers and authorities to the federal government, and it set limitations on the federal government. It also set limitations and granted some authorities to the states. The Republican form was one of the authorities granted, but they couldn't coin money and all this. There were a lot of things they couldn't do. They couldn't do treaties. They couldn't engage in war. They could protect against invasion, but they could not declare war on another country, because we're United States now, and one state then can't embroil the other states in a war. And if they did, as say Arizona started a war with Mexico, then that would embroil the entire country, because we're united and we have to work together. The whole idea in common defense. So the right to declare war in the Constitution, for example, was granted to the Congress, not to the President, for a damn good reason. Somehow we've deviated from that since World War II, from Korea on. Basically, Congress has stayed out of the picture of declaring war. The last time we declared war was December of 1941 against Germany and Italy. So this concept of a stable constitution, remember, a written constitution per se did not exist in history prior to the adoption of the United States Constitution. So here we've got a fixed foundation from which a government can grow. Does it have errors in it? Yes. How can you anticipate the future? Which is why they put the amendment process in, so it could be fixed, and that was done within a few years. So how that can be despotic or tyrannical is beyond me, because everything was fixed and everybody knew what they were getting into. And that was true for the first, say, 60 years, 70 years under that Constitution. It was pretty fixed. They did not deviate from that general foundation called the Constitution for the United States of America.
Well, Gary, I mean, when I was growing up, I remember my parents teaching me that what was great about the United States Constitution, or at least part of it, was that it was essentially this great experiment in limited government, and it was never done before and so forth, especially considering the English Constitution was mainly unwritten. But something I've noticed about people who really push this Philadelphia conspiracy claim is their advocacy in favor of the Articles of Confederation. And this seems, from what I can tell, it seems to take two flavors. The one flavor is where they just simply prefer the Articles to the U.S. Constitution. And then the other flavor, which is a little bit almost stranger to me, is where they claim the Articles were never extinguished. So
Well,
on the
let's
first
deal with
one,
one. Okay, let's deal with the first one. The Articles of Confederation ratified in 1781, finally submitted in 1777, ratified in 1781, and so we've got 6 years prior to the Philadelphia Conspiracy Convention, in which this Articles of Confederation fully operated. Article 2 of that says each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence. Hey, that sounds wonderful. That's what we look for today. And every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Well, that might be a good thing, but wait, we're a union, so there has to be a degree of conformity and agreement between unions. Otherwise, if this was true, then some of the circumstances that existed after the war, after 1781, when an example would be New York and New Jersey. If a ship came in from overseas and had goods for New York and New Jersey, if it landed in New York first, New York would impose duties on that ship, including the goods to be, since they landed at New York, would put impose duties on the goods that were going to New Jersey. Now, then when the ship crossed the river and went to New Jersey, a duty had already been paid on the goods, and so if New Jersey collected a duty to manage their ports, then that would double the duty that was imposed upon the goods. So something that was shipped over from England would cost more in New Jersey than it would in New York. So it was a battle between states quite often. How do you resolve something like that? New Jersey's alternative was to not charge a duty, so I guess they'll collect soda pop bottles to pay for their ports and the maintenance of the ports and the port customs inspectors and things like that. But they had every right to collect a duty, which again, like I say, imposed an additional cost on the goods when they were delivered into this country, which made it difficult for the merchants. There were a lot of other circumstances similar to that where there's a conflict between states. An inland state, for example, that didn't have a port would have to pay, might have to pay duties to go through an exterior state. Now, at the time, I don't think that there were any non-seaboard states, with the possibility of Vermont, that would be subject to duties within the state they transported their goods just to get them to the coast to ship them to Europe to be sold, and then they would pay duties to the seaboard state that received those before they were transported back up to Vermont, say. So you can see what the problems were, because each state was free and independent to every power, jurisdiction, and right, as Article 2 says. And if it wasn't delegated to the United States, which none of these were, then it was up to each state. So the states would be at each other's throats over what was happening among them. And theoretically, a state could charge a higher duty to one state and a lower duty to another state for the same thing. It was complete independence, and that was a bar against, you know, practical commerce. And commerce is necessary for, it still is necessary. Unfortunately, today it's China, it's not Europe, and we buy everything from there, and we've hurt our own commerce by doing it. But back then, that commerce was vital to the lifeblood, because no state produced everything it needed for the comfort of its people. So that was Article 2. Let's go down to Article 8. All charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state granted or surveyed for any person. So all occupied land became the foundation for this assessment to offset the cost for the common defense and the general warfare. As such, land and buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint. So there was an assessment on the states, and it was done by the Congress assembled, and they even set out the criteria based on occupied land, land that had transferred to a person, because a lot of it still was owned by the crown, is now owned by the states, is not inhabited. So then next, in the same article, the taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. So, to offset the war debt, we borrowed substantial sums from France and from Holland, and some from other countries where it was more trade, but France and Holland primarily funded the Revolutionary War. The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied, based on that criteria, by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. So, if the states levy it but don't collect it, and don't do so with the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled, there's nothing to punish those states. Hey, yeah, I owe the money, but hey, I don't have it. I've got better places to spend my money, so I'm not going to pay my share. So some states paid their debt to the Continental Congress. Others did not. They didn't even, some didn't even pay a penny. Some stayed paid partial. But the thing was, there was no way to offset this debt. Now, what does that do to the United States as a country or as a union, a perpetual union? Well, if I wanted to borrow money from Holland in the future because there was going to be another war in, let's say, about 20 years, could I go to Holland or France and borrow money to fight that war? No, you didn't pay your debt last time. You guys are credit. You don't have credit anymore because you don't pay your obligations. So unless the states that were willing to pay paid for those that weren't willing to pay, the credit of the United States was decimated. Now, how can you be an established country in the world when everybody looks at you and says, they don't pay their debts? I'm not going to help them. They don't deserve to exist because they do not fulfill their obligations when they borrow money. And that's exactly what this laid out because it was left to the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. Another problem with the, that was a problem with the Articles of Confederation. Now, then in Article 9, here's another one. The United States and Congress assembled shall never engage in war nor grant letters of marque or reprisal in time of peace, nor enter into any treaties or alliances, nor coin money, nor regulate the value thereof, nor ascertain the sums and expenses necessary for the defense and welfare of the United States or any of them, nor remember, United States was plural then, nor borrow any money on the credit of the United States, nor appropriate money, unless nine states assent to the same. So, Congress can't do anything unless they've got nine of the 13 colonies agreeing to anything for the defense. So, if, say, Florida and Georgia were attacked, and the New England state says, well, we don't care about them, all they do is grow cotton and pine trees, and we can get our cotton from other states. So, unless you get those nine states to agree, there's no common defense. It's destroyed, the whole concept. And really, during the War of 1812, there was a conflict over whether we should go to war or not. Most people don't realize that we declared war on England. They didn't declare a war on us in the War of 1812. And there was a lot of conflict within the states, and a lot of it's reflected in the Declaration of War, where they even pointed out that England had people, subversive people in our government trying to destroy the Union. And the Union was really torn between whether we should enter or not in the War of 1812. But we had enough votes, we declared war. But under the Articles of Confederation, if the United States decided to declare war, they've got to have money, and we're stuck with the same thing again. The states don't have to pay their share. So we're stuck borrowing to offset what can't be acquired from those states agreeable to the war. And that it was a good example because the states opposed to it voted against it in the Constitutional Congress. But under the Articles of Confederation, they just wouldn't have paid it. They weren't willing to do their share for the common defense when it's agreed upon by the sufficient majority to enter in. And they also said, nor appoint a commander in chief of the army or navy unless nine states assent to the same. Now, George Washington had the nine, but what if they can't come to terms on who's going to be the commander in chief in the army or navy, and they can't get the three thir or 9/13 vote for any one leader? So we go, the army would go headless until such time as somehow they negotiated an agreement. So there's a problem in defense of the country right there under the Articles of Confederation. In Article 12 of the Articles of Confederation, all bills of credit emitted, monies borrowed, and debts contracted by or under the authority of Congress before the assembling of the United States in pursuance of the present Confederation shall be deemed and considered as a charge against the United States for payment and satisfaction whereof the said United States and the public faith are hereby solemnly pledged. Now, let's take back to the earlier conversation. By that time, we'd borrowed from France. Remember, this was proposed in 1777, but it wasn't ratified. It didn't become reality until the end of the war, 1781. So we had borrowed all this money from France and Holland. So they all agreed when they adopted and ratified the Articles of Confederation that all bills of credit emitted, monies borrowed, and everything under the authority of this Congress are brought forward, and we accept them as legitimate debt. But wait, let's go back to what we talked about before. The states were unwilling to pay what they, in Congress, they agreed the debts was owed, but in the state assemblies, they said, we ain't going to pay it. So they brought the debt forward from prior to the Articles of Confederation, and so they all agreed to the obligation, and then they rejected that obligation by not paying their fair share. Again, a problem with the Articles of Confederation. And just going into the significant ones, really. But the next one, every state shall abide by the determination of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this Confederation are submitted to them, and the Articles of this Confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state. Now, every state shall abide by the determination of Congress assembled on all questions which this Confederation has submitted to them. Well, that gives a lot of power. If any state has a question, the nine-state requirement for voting applies. So they're kind of stuck. They've given federal authority to this Congress in any question that goes before them. That means they can't solve their own problem. And I would assume that if, say, somebody from South Carolina sued the state of North Carolina, for example, that, you know, automatically, since it's two states, it crosses those lines, it would be heard by the Congress, and they would make the determination, screw North Carolina, screw South Carolina, nine states would make the determination. And it also says, the union shall be perpetual, nor shall any alteration at any time hereafter be made in any of them, unless such alteration be agreed upon to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state. Now, to change the Articles of Perpetual Union, if they submitted a proposal, it had to go to all the states. And every state, unanimity was required for any changes in the Articles of Confederation. And there were a number of proposed revisions to the Articles of Confederation during almost the entire period of its existence. In one that I don't recall the specifics, but New York held out all the way through. New York would never approve it. Therefore, it never got approved. There were others. So it's problematic when you require confirmed by the legislatures of every state, the unanimity that was required to make any changes in this document. Now, let's take what we talked about a little while ago. This same group of people, and I don't know if, quite frankly, I don't know if every state legislature confirmed it or not. But this Congress did send the Constitution out to the states to be ratified by convention within the states. There were other lesser problems with the Articles of Confederation, but I wanted to highlight the ones that were more easily demonstrable and reflect on some of the problems that existed at the time. There were many more, and I think almost to a man in this country at that time, they agreed that the Articles of Confederation were not workable. However, they were formed during a time of war. And so you got these 13 little colonies that had to work together to defeat England. So for the expediency of war, it was good. But it was based on the assumption that each state would pay its fair share. But it broke down. And most of that debt was absorbed again, like they absorbed the debt, the pre-articles. The Constitution absorbed the debt pre-Constitution. So this debt got passed all the way up for 12
Gary,
years.
from some of these articles you've read from, it sounds as if some of the state legislatures were trying to welch on their war debt.
I wouldn't say they were trying to welch. They found a better use for the money. Some states were more devastated than others. The South was brutal. New Jersey got raked over the coals with the constant coming and going. Other states, Massachusetts didn't have a whole lot going on except around Boston. New York City, that the whole island area got devastated. Connecticut had damage. Rhode Island had very little. So, it varied back and forth, and perhaps, we suffered more damage, we've got to repair the damage. That might have been a factor in saying, well, we're paying our debt by rebuilding our state. It's hard to say what their motivation was. I haven't run across it. All I know is they didn't pay their debts. That's acknowledged because it was tallied. Hey, this state paid, this state paid, this one paid, this one paid a little bit, this one paid none. That's the only facts I found so far. But it didn't work. And so that debt had to be carried to the third government, from the first government, Continental Congress, to the Articles of Confederation, United States Congress, to the Constitutional Congress.
Well, I mean, as far as those who seem to favor or prefer the Articles of Confederation, it seems to kind of revolve around this one idea that the Articles provided for an even more limited government than the U.S. Constitution does. And in that respect, that might be true considering that there's no president, there's no presidency, and there's no federal judiciary.
Well,
But then again,
there was one branch of government.
the legislature, the
Right, and it
Congress.
acted as judiciary in resolving disputes. It acted as legislative in enacting laws. The biggest deficiency was there was no executive because there was no way to enforce the collection of debt, for example. There was no way to enforce not letting New York charge duties on goods that were not landed, but just docked at New York before they went to New Jersey. There was no way to enforce it. There was no executive. Executive is one that carries out the law. Legislative makes it. Judicial makes determination when a question arises. We were missing that legislative and judicial were merged, but there was no executive. There was no person or body or anything, entity, that could enforce these laws. There
That
was
doesn't sound like a separation of power, though. If anything, that sounds like a centralization of power, in this case in the Congress.
right, and at least if they had a provision to remove a state for noncompliance with the agreement, and it required nine states to do it, they could have removed a state. But there was no provision to even do that. So there was nothing punitive in that entire document. There was it said you shall, but there was no way to enforce that shall. It was without teeth. There were no teeth in it at all.
Well, I think what's probably stranger than the one flavor of the preference for Articles Confederation is this other claim that it was never extinguished. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but I could have sworn the Articles of Confederation were no longer the law of the land, as it were, once the United States Constitution was ratified in the 1780s.
Well, let's go back to I use the analogy of a state creating two states. When it separates from the first state, it no longer exists in that first state mode. Let's look at it another way. Perpetual union. Fine, that's a great statement. No teeth, but great statement. So the Congress of that perpetual union decided to pass on something that would destroy that perpetual union, didn't it? They chose to pass it on to the states for ratification. They sent it out. And they never challenged the ratification process. They never complained. There might have been individuals that complained, but the United States Congress under the Articles of Confederation never complained as to the illegitimacy, at least within their requirements. You know, like some members did, but they never had nine states say, this is illegitimate. So it must have been legitimate in the eyes of that Congress that what was being proposed as the United States of America was not a violation of the tenets of the perpetual union. So now, does, if we switch governments, do we still carry the residual of that previous government? Let me ask you, what did we carry from England that was mandatory on us when we kicked England out? Now, we kicked the Articles of Confederation out without bloodshed, but we used bloodshed to kick England out. But in a sense, they're the same thing. We disposed of the English government to create our own. We disposed of the Articles of Confederation to create our own.
Yeah, there is a dissolution of government involved.
Right, and let's go back one more step. It's called the Declaration of Independence. Now, I wouldn't say that the Articles of Confederation, the United States Congress under the Articles of Confederation was despotic, but it is our right, it's our duty to change it to make it better. So the Declaration laid the foundation for the creation of the United States under the Constitution. It didn't work, let's get rid of it. Does it have to be despotic to get rid of it? No, because it has to suit the people. Doesn't it? Shouldn't it? And that's why it began, We the People, because this was truly the first time that the people of a country created a government of their own choosing. The Articles of Confederation was done by the legislatures of the various states. The United States Constitution was ratified by the people of the United States. Which leads us to Lysander Spooner, doesn't it?
Or at least deeply questions the validity of his argument that it was some sort of illegitimate contract, essentially. Well, I mean, something else, too, that seems to run parallel is this other diatribe that those who push this Philadelphia conspiracy claim like to go on about, is they like to, I guess you could say, question the legitimacy of the Whiskey Rebellion.
Well, let's go one other place first. You know, you brought up Lysander Spooner before, and Lysander Spooner said something like, I didn't personally sign the Constitution, therefore it's not it's invalid. And I think we need to enter that realm before we go into the Whiskey Rebellion, which was the first test of the authority of the Constitution. If it's
sure.
Okay with you, okay?
Sure, so, yeah. Spooner did argue that at length in his No Treason essay, yes.
And I, you know, people say it to me all the time. Well, patriot mythology is looking for problems, not for solutions. Lysander Spooner in the Constitution of No, what was it? Constitution of No Consequence?
No, it was No Treason number 6, the Constitution of No Authority.
Of No Authority, okay. That points out a lot of problems, and I've read it, you know, and I have trouble reading it, really, because it's laughable. But he makes the premise that that if I didn't sign it, then I'm not bound by it. So did he offer a solution in that entire diatribe of his? He never offered a solution for anything he posed as a problem. But let's look at this one. I didn't personally sign the Constitution, therefore it's invalid. So let's see. How are we going to deal? Let's find a solution to this. Okay, average generation, 20 years. So every 20 years, are we going to put the Constitution up for a revote? Now, in the 20 years, we've got people of age 1 to 21 coming in. Do we put it to a revote? And then 21 years later, a revote again. Seems kind of like a waste of time, because we do have a provision in there that allows it to be amended by subsequent generations. But how can it be a solid foundation, again, back to what the states did when it was done by the legislatures rather than the people in convention, Does it have to go out to convention first, and the conventions argue and debate, and then we, at this point, get 50 different contributions of what the Constitution could be? Now we've got to reconcile them and find out what the final wording will be, and then we submit this Constitution to the states, and it says, oh, we're not going to have as many representatives. Okay, well, how are we going to get rid of these representatives that are still in office? Actually, we could say senators because they're a 6-year term, but you're going to have to spend a fortune and have chaos in reinstituting the government every 20 years. But maybe if it requires a signature every year, everybody that turned 21 should be able to vote on it. But wait, are we going to give them the vote so they can override the people 22 to 65? No, so we have to have everyone from 21 to 65 vote on it. Now, that's cumbersome to get all those people to vote every year. So how can we apply a satisfaction to his statement that has any common sense? And I've been, you know, asking people that have brought this to my attention, and everybody scratches their head. Nobody has any inkling of a means of addressing that I didn't personally sign it. So let's look at it one more way. We spent 21 years of our lives living under the benefit of this great document. Can we object to it at this point, after we've achieved the benefit of it? That's like saying, okay, I bought this car and I agreed to pay $1,000 and I've only paid $500, but I want to keep the car and not pay the rest of my obligation. You've received the benefit. You've got the car. You have the obligation. Now, that obligation does have an escape clause, but you've got to get everyone from 21 to 65 to agree to amendment to that Constitution. It only makes sense. That'd be like negotiating, well, I only think the car is worth $900 now that I've driven it and had to get all those repairs, and we come to an agreement, an amendment to the contract, and say, okay, $900 instead of $1,000. But the obligation's still there unless it's modified by an agreement on the contract price, for example, or an agreement on an amendment to make it better from this point forward. So there's no solution under the problem pointed to by Spooner. I mean, I think that problem is so absurd that it's not even worthy of consideration. But in for the purpose of explaining that deficiency, being very polite about it, absurdity, I didn't personally sign the Constitution, therefore it's invalid, has to be addressed. Now, if it is invalid, what does that mean? I'm not bound by the Constitution? Constitution doesn't bind me anyway.
Spooner claimed that it didn't bind anybody. Well, or he's making this presumption that it does bind people.
It doesn't. Let's go back and look at what it does. It lists about five or six crimes in it. Treason, counterfeiting, piracy, a few things like that. Those act on the people directly. Now, we're talking about the first 70 years of the Constitution. Let's stick to that. Does it bind me? Where does it bind me? All it does is protect my rights. Habeas corpus, militia, free speech, free press, right of assembly, religion. It protects things. It doesn't bind me to anything. It does bind Congress to the powers and authorities granted and to the limitations presented. But it doesn't tell me I have to do anything. Now, the question of whether the government can do something that binds me or not is a whole other issue. And let's go back. Let's step right into the Whiskey Rebellion. One of the authorities granted was to impose excise taxes. Everybody agreed to that in the state conventions when they ratified the Constitution. So it was an unfortunate situation, to say the least, because back then, I've got conversion tables that, you know, they compared, 20 or 30 different types of coin that were floating around this country at the time and said what their equivalent was in dollars or shillings, English shillings and pounds. All this coin circulated in this country, but there were parts of this country where people never saw a whole dollar in their whole life. So you've got these people in, where was it, Western Massachusetts or Pennsylvania? Where was it?
Western Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, right? Okay. That's the frontier. Pittsburgh didn't exist at the time as a city. It was Fort Pitt at the time at best, or Fort Defiance, or whatever. I don't recall what the name was. So you've got these people out there that, you know, in a community of 500 people, there might, or let's say 100 people, there might be $5 or $10 in all in specie. Now, taxes had to be paid in specie because there was no fiat currency. So I grow all this corn. I don't have enough mules and horses to eat it, and I'm getting sick of popcorn. What am I going to do with all this corn? Well, I can convert it to alcohol. And so they convert it to alcohol, and then they start trading. I need some chickens, so I'll give you a couple of gallons of my hooch for a couple of your chickens. Okay. Hey, I need a cow. I'll give you 12 gallons of hooch for your for one of your cows. It's barter. However, when the law was enacted under the authority of the excise tax, it says the production of alcohol will be have an excise tax imposed of so much per gallon. That's the law. It was agreed to. It's in complete conformity to the Constitution. So here comes the first real test of this new government. Does the government, under the Constitution, with specific authority to impose an excise tax, have the authority to both impose that tax and to force collection of that tax? So, what do you think, Sleepy?
Well, I mean, from what I understand of from my American civics classes, it was pretty much that the whiskey tax was constitutional and that the farmers just disagreed. They were, I believe, that many of them were Revolutionary War veterans and that they basically viewed the tax as basically something like what the British Empire had done, and they. Their attitude, more or less, was that, well, we just finished a war to resist things like this, and so, geez, we're just going to have to do it again.
In
So, yeah, it was an issue of constitutionality.
a sense, yes. In fact, you could call them the first sovereign citizens under the
Ouch.
Constitution. These laws don't apply to me. I voted for ratification, or at least my community voted for ratification, but I'm not bound by it. So, you know, the problem was, and probably there was a lot of mindset. There was a lot of discussion at the time, but let's get back to the elite aspect of this. This is rather interesting because with the ratification of the elite or the Constitution, the elite relinquished their power. Prior to that, if you weren't of wealth, if you weren't a gentleman, and Alexander Hamilton until the Constitution was not a gentleman. He could hold nothing but a military office. He could not hold a government office because he was not a gentleman. So the elite ruled this country until the Revolutionary War. And so the elite, in the Declaration of Independence and subsequently in the Constitution, relinquished their right to rule. And there was an era of independence because, you know, the British rule was oppressive in many areas. And so when these guys fought for independence, they thought that they were creating anarchy. They could do anything they wanted. Now, of course, the government might have built some of the roads. The what is now the Pennsylvania Parkway was built by the government in defending Pittsburgh. So the benefits, the roads they were traveling on were no longer cow trails or deer trails or walking trails. They were roadways. Bridges built, elevated causeways built so that they could go from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. So they were benefiting by what happened. They didn't go shovel the dirt in. They were just making whiskey. And their objection, psychologically perhaps had merit, but there was a future ahead of this country. And that future had to be assured. And had they relinquished to the will of those that objected to the authority of the United States government under the Constitution, where would we be today? Now, that's, again, when I say today, we're talking about the first 60 or 70 years under the Constitution. So I can understand that they had the mindset that we've fought for independence and I'm independent, but they're not putting in perspective that we fought for independence so that the states had independence and the country had independence from England.
Well, regarding the perceived legitimacy of the Whiskey Rebellion, and this questioning of its legitimacy being done by those who push this Philadelphia conspiracy claim, I was able to track back pretty much all the different versions of this, pretty much to one source, which in some ways is kind of funny, because it was actually a fictional novel written back in the 1980s.
And I think you said there are some points in there that bring out, not non-fictional, bring out some of the issues of the Whiskey Rebellion. Is that right?
Something like that, yeah. In a chapter of this novel, which was actually titled The Constitution Conspiracy, so you can kind of get an idea where they're going to go with that, there was this one paragraph I'd like to read, which I think kind of encapsulates more the attitude of what was of how they viewed the Constitutional Convention. Quote, "The fiend responsible for this counter-revolutionary nastiness was Alexander Hamilton, a name Confederates hold in about the same esteem as the word spittoon. He and his Federalists had shoved down the country's throat their constitution, which was a charter for a centralist superstate, replacing the 13 mini-governments that had been operating under the inefficient but tolerable Articles of Confederation. Adopted during an illegal and unrepresentative meeting in Philadelphia, originally authorized only to revise the articles, this new document amounted to a bloodless coup d'etat." Close quote.
Okay, let's back up. We got to take one piece at a time. So go back through there. Probably start at the back and work up and come up to the points. You had one about a whole sentence before that last sentence.
Sure, Alexander Hamilton was
No, start at
basically
the
a
back. Start at the back. You had
Oh,
one.
back. Okay, sorry. Okay, so the Constitution is a bloodless coup d'etat.
Well. So maybe a suicide. If they're correct in their presumption that it was bad, then that would be a suicide because the majority supported the Constitution. So I wouldn't call that the coup d'état, would you? If I hold a
Probably.
gun to my head and shoot it instead of the other guy, is it a coup d'état or suicide?
People more suicide. Yeah, but that's the problem is that you can't even really call it a coup d'etat because, again, of what was recorded in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers with it being all very public and all that. Coup d'etats don't have public discussions about, how
Public
shall we then
votes,
live?
right, a public vote.
Yeah,
So, yeah, I
yeah.
mean, that's absurd. So back up another sentence or so.
Illegal and unrepresentative meeting in Philadelphia. So this is the behind closed doors aspect that I think
Well,
he's trying to
I
highlight.
think we've addressed that. It wasn't illegal because the Continental Congress called for the United States Congress called for them to meet in Philadelphia to look for revisions to the Articles of Confederation. They got there and they discussed it briefly, but based on the problems they had, for example, New York never agreeing to one of the elements that would change the Articles of Confederation, and I think it had to do with the tax issue. They wanted to revise that to get uniform duties. How could anything get done? They could spend 2 years there and come up with 50 ideas, but unless they had unanimous consent of all the both nine votes in the Congress and then unanimous consent of the states, nothing changed. It's kind of absurd to think that there any change could come under the Articles of Confederation. And I read the problematic portions. There are more portions that are problematic, but the significantly problematic portions of the Articles of Confederation. So if they authorized this and then it was done and then it went back to them and they sent it to the states, how is it unauthorized or illegal?
Yeah, that doesn't quite make any sense. Another aspect too is when it was described here as the Constitution being a charter for a centralist superstate replacing the 13 mini governments. So I think he's trying to imply that it
Okay,
like centralized political
it
power.
was centralized in a democratic form because in the House of Representatives, by population, the people were directly represented by their representatives. That's not centralized in an elite or anything. The Senate, 6-year term, each state has 2 votes. Is
Right,
that
I think.
centralized? I mean, these guys are
No,
traveling
it's
cross
not.
country to get there. How do you call that centralized? The only thing that might be considered centralized under the Constitution as written and intended was the fact that they created an executive. You know, you could say, and some described it back then, is we have created a monarchy. However, it's a limited term, and it's got very severe limitations put on it. But the only thing they could equate the executive authority to was a monarchy, because in Europe at that time, everything was a monarchy, and the monarchy had the job. Now, England, the revolution in 1640, 1650, had taken a lot of power away from the monarchy and left it with Parliament. But still, the executive, the monarch, was the one that carried out the laws. And so we created, in a sense, a monarchy, but it was very limited. It wasn't perpetual, it wasn't hereditary. It was by election. It lasted 4 years. And it was with the consent of the people. So we created a king with limited powers. Article 2 of the Constitution sets what his powers are. But you had to
Right.
have a degree of centralization in that authority for administration. They had talked about committees. They had talked a number of different methods of treating the executive, but they knew from the articles they had to have some teeth, and that teeth was embodied in the executive branch of government. So they looked for what they felt was the best solution for the teeth, on how the teeth should be held. And veto power was one of the teeth that carry over from England, because they'd given him authority and it was against what he felt was right, he could veto. But wait, they could override the veto. So there were provisions put in here to not let that power be suppressive in veto, nor authoritative, because, for example, Article 1, Section 8 gives the powers of Congress, not to the executive branch of government, but to Congress. Right to declare war. But now, see, we've got to stick to up until the Civil War when we talk about the Constitution, because that's when it operated as intended by the founders. After beginning with the Civil War, and you know, this is a different discussion that I don't think we need to go into now. After the Civil War, things changed, and when people look back, they look at what we have now and say that's not consistent with the Constitution. And my response is, no shit, GI. It's not. And that changed in 1861. But if we look at the Constitution as written and intended, ratified and applied for those first 60 or 70 years, it was very consistent with the Constitution. And there were people like Andrew Jackson that said, I'm not going to enforce that law. But hey, the people would either re-elect Jackson or not, depending on what he said. The law was passed, it was on the books, but he said, I'm not going to enforce it. So, it was a good balance. It worked.
Yeah, and like I mentioned earlier, at least the U.S. Constitution has got that separation of powers going on, but there is no separation of powers in the
It did
Articles.
have. Oh, right. You had the judicial and the legislative mixed into one. So we enact the laws, and then we determine what the laws we enacted are. But
Yeah, if anything, that's a centralization of power, yeah.
With that, the judicial could make a determination, and a state could say, up yours, we're not going to do it, which basically they did as far as the repayment of debt. So there was
Right.
no teeth. It was absolutely without teeth. And
The last.
therefore, it was kind of absurd. It was a gentleman's agreement.
Well, the last part of this, or I should say the first part of the paragraph, was this, about Alexander Hamilton and his Federalists shoving down the country's throat the Constitution. It's actually interesting in this novel, throughout
Well,
the antagonist.
let's stick with the point. Alexander Hamilton. Everybody wants to criticize Hamilton, but if you read the Federalist Papers and read what Hamilton wrote, frequently in discussions, I'll refer to something Hamilton said, and people say, "Hey, you're not a Federalist. You don't believe in a strong central government. How come you're quoting Hamilton. Well, if Hamilton's on my side, obviously the government's not. They've
Yeah, they're
gone to
very
an
much is that
extreme.
presumption. Yeah.
But Hamilton was tasked, and the reason he was appointed Secretary of the Treasury is he'd worked in merchants' counting houses and things like this, and some people have a head for accounting and others don't. The government had to get out of debt. They had to resolve the debt problems. And I pointed out the problems. The states aren't willing to contribute the money. Alexander Hamilton, within a few years, resolved the debt that we owed. He created, without Federal Reserve banks, without excessive borrowing power, but using the tools granted by the Constitution, put together a financial plan that resolved our debt, got everything current, and all of a sudden we were at peace with the world. We didn't have France and Holland saying, "Hey, you screwed us." He did the job that he was tasked to do, and he did it better than probably anybody else could have. As much as I despise the son of a bitch for some of the things he pushed for, he solved the problem that was, to most, was insurmountable. So let's criticize the guy for doing, using the tools that were in the toolbox that was given him for accomplishing the task of which he was assigned.
Well, in this novel, I mean, Alexander, the descendants of Alexander Hamilton, not hereditary, but his, people who followed his political ideology or versions thereof, were basically, they are not just indirectly, but they are explicitly portrayed as the antagonists of this novel. They are literally the villains, which was kind of surprising to me. And something I've noticed about folks who push this Philadelphia conspiracy idea is that they really pretty much universally despise Hamilton because real world Hamilton advocated for a central bank. And I think that has a lot to do with it. But yeah, I mean, like, for example, in this novel, they also presume the Whiskey Rebellion was successful, again, in a fictional novel, and they even describe George Washington, it says, went to the wall, which means he was executed. Now, of course, real world, that didn't happen. Washington lived for a good many years later, but it's rather interesting for me to see that tracking back, actual journalism, tracking back all the different sources and claims who like to push this conspiracy idea, it all goes back to this one novel where the author wished Alexander Hamilton to be this villain and for George Washington to be publicly executed for trying to enforce the whiskey tax, I find to be rather shocking, to put it mildly.
Well, think about it. What's a revisionist?
Someone who basically tries to rewrite history.
Right. Now, who is the father of our country?
George Washington.
Who was elected into the executive office of government twice unanimously?
George Washington.
Who, without him, we probably would have failed in our battle with England.
Oh, George
Oh,
Washington.
that evil son of a bitch, shoot him.
Yeah, it's about that bad.
It is, and it makes a fine story for people that don't pay attention or want to believe something that destroys the traditions and the heritage of this great, once great nation. And I say once great, and I believe it can be great again because it was a great nation, and even with all that had occurred before then, until the 1960s, was a great nation. It was a model to the rest of the world. It was able to save most of Europe from being taken over by a dictator. It was able to save the Soviet Union from being taken over by a dictator. It was able to take Australia and many parts of Asia and keep them, most of Asia, from being taken over by a dictatorial government. Hey, that's greatness.
Yeah. And I mean, generally speaking, I like the founders. But one thing I did not appreciate about that novel was how they tried to do the whole divide and conquer bit. So
Well,
for instance, like Washington and Hamilton being villains, but then Thomas Jefferson being the savior. So they like Jefferson. So you see what I'm saying? It's this very strange thing they have going on here, and people
it is,
like
but
believe it.
look what's happened to Jefferson since. He was a misogynist. He fathered Negro children. Now, people say that because genetically they show that the Jefferson family genes are in the descendants of whatever that lady's name was. But wait, didn't Jefferson's father have the same genes? And didn't his Jefferson's father, wasn't Jefferson appalled at his father's sleeping with the slaves?
Right, because
But
of yeah, how do you
he
have
would have the same genes, wouldn't he?
yeah, right, because of the similarities in DNA, right.
But demonizing, if you want to destroy a country, what's necessary for a nation to exist? A common language, a common heritage, and a common culture. And probably similarity in religion as well, to some degree, a similarity in religion. And we have all those elements. Now, if we take that heritage and start destroying that heritage, we're chipping away at one of the four principal foundations of the necessities of a nation.
And then, of course, it begs the question, what's left at that point?
Right? And then we start going after the culture. Now, the
Well,
culture mixes with religion to some degree, but the celebrations that we've held dear for a long time, people are attacking Thanksgiving now. What
yeah,
about the
that's kind of
language?
ridiculous.
Oh, push one for English, two for Spanish. I don't get it.
Oh, I live here in Texas, so I know what you're talking about on
So
that one.
what's happening is this foundation, the necessities to make a nation, cohesive nation, are being hit at one at a time. Now, who's doing it? Who was it? Let's see. Nikita Khrushchev took his shoe off and pounded it on the table at the UN assembly back in the 60s and said, "We will bury you." And there have been a lot of other predictions about the destruction of the United States, and they were all based on subversion. Subverting our heritage, subverting our culture, subverting our language, subverting our religions. They just had a Muslim prayer in the National Cathedral.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know about that.
Now, could we have a Christian prayer in the mosque? How about in the at Mecca? Oh, hey, you
Oh,
can't even go in Mecca. If
right,
you're
of
not a
course.
Muslim, you cannot go in that building at Mecca.
Yeah, it's considered a holy site.
Right? And our national cathedral has held the same stature in this country, and it has submitted to multiculturalism.
Well, it's political correctness, right?
Well, multiculturalism is what destroys the common language, common heritage, common culture, and the similarity of religion.
Well, when it comes to things like that, there's never any sense of fair play because it is presumed that that those who are not American are supreme, or they have a supremacy over us.
Well,
It's like we've been conquered.
diversity and appeasement.
Yeah.
Political correctness is a tool to achieve those. Appeasement. We appease them. Oh, we're the greatest country in the world. Or we used to be, but don't say that out loud. And yes, we're willing to let you bring your pagan rituals into our national cathedral and into our churches and into our schools. Of course, we can't take our religion into our schools, and we're limited in what our religion can say in their own pulpits. But hey, you can come in and say anything you want.
Right, there's no sense of fair play is the point.
No, there's
It's not
not.
like what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Right. And
It does not apply here.
appeasement is acting the role of the good guy, the white hat, and hoping that the other side is as honorable as you are.
Except that they're not, and the next thing you know, we're in a position of subjugation.
Right, exactly what happened leading to World War II when, what was his name before Churchill, kept appeasing, Chamberlain, kept
Yeah.
appeasing England, or Germany. Oh, we're just going to take a little bit here, a little bit there. Now we got to take a little bit more over here. Okay, go right ahead, but you're going to stop there, aren't you? Yeah, we're going to stop there. Oh, wait, we got to take this too because we got people who speak German over there. Well, okay, but you're going to stop after this, right? Yeah. Okay, we're going to go up in the lowlands and we're going to start taking the lowlands. Well, because they speak German. Well, you're
It's a
going to
boiling
stop after
frog.
that. And finally, they took France, and that was it. It's all over when they decided to take France.
Yeah, just a little bit faster version of the boiling frog again, one more time. I mean, it's
Right, and that's
so.
exactly what we're doing today in appeasing people that want to destroy our language, our heritage, our culture, and our religious similarity.
Right. So, Gary, I mean, what do you think people misunderstand when it comes to the U.S. Constitution?
Well, everything as it's applied today. Separation of church and state. Hey, that's not what it says. That's what Thomas Jefferson said. Did he say it in the context that is used in the courts and in the arguments in the mainstream media? Hell no, he didn't mean that.
No, it was just in a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, and it was his personal interpretation of the free exercise and establishment clauses.
Right.
That was it. It wasn't a very long letter at all.
Right, and I think the context is wrong too, because when you read the Danbury letter, when he's talking about a wall of separation, it was really a one-way wall, wasn't it?
Well,
Government shall not cross the wall and involve itself in religion.
right.
Remember, even all the work that Jefferson did in Virginia. And in the United States, they did not remove that under God in the oath, or the oath and the religious aspects of obligation. He never challenged Congress having prayer before every session.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, if you go back a little bit further, I don't, I think Ben Franklin was one of the guys who got them in the habit of, praying and so forth, or he was one
Right.
of them anyway. So it's a regular part of the history
Right, and
to
if you
pray.
read the his religious liberty in Virginia, he doesn't say that it doesn't. He says the state cannot impose. He didn't say that the religion cannot be a part of it. And then we go a little further too, because the government has stolen the word public from us, and in so doing, what they have done is they have moved it behind that one-way wall that Jefferson created to the two-way wall they've created, and they've taken public property and put it on the other side of that two-way wall, assuming that they own the public property, not the people themselves.
Right, and the next
So,
thing you know, we've got IRS 501c3
right.
churches
But
who when they where they can't don't have free speech.
anyway, we're talking about Philadelphia conspiracy, and I think we pretty much exhausted that. What do you think?
Well, I think you were definitely correct when you mentioned earlier about with regards to Spooner about whining about problems instead of focusing on solutions. And
Well,
I think in a lot of ways that's kind of what this kind of comes down to.
think about it. The people that are espousing Spooner and all these other arguments, Philadelphia conspiracy, they're pointing out problems, no solutions, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly right. Because there's nothing about either restoring constitutional government or anything along those lines.
If it works, don't fix it. If it don't work, fix it. And fixing it was provided for in the Constitution. With the amendment process, and it was also provided for in a previous document from 1776. So the solution is there. It's just until we're upset enough to realize that we have to resort to the amendment process, which is difficult because it doesn't go to the people. Most amendments now are ratified by the state legislature, so that's kind of out because of that oversight. The Constitution had to be created by convention of the people, but not the amendments. So that pushes us back one more step to it is your right, it is your duty to change such system.
Right, alter or abolish. Yeah. So, well, thanks, Gary. I did kind of wanted to get your take on that because I've just been hearing this kind of stuff for years, and I just kind of wanted to get it settled in my mind kind of once and for all. So I definitely wanted to thank you for your help on that.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're satisfied with the discussion.